is efficient arithmetic on elliptic curves in large characteristic. Actually, I'm going to be talking about techniques for efficient arithmetic that apply to elliptic curves generally, but the small characteristic case has more speed-ups, and you're going to be hearing in the next talk about applying general techniques and characteristic 2 techniques to speed-up elliptic curves in characteristic 2. I'm going to focus on large characteristic, for instance, elliptic curves over a large prime field. Imagine that somebody gives you some large prime field and some elliptic curve over it. For instance, here's some standard elliptic curves that are good for cryptography. They've been chosen to be safe for cryptography, resist all the attacks that we know. One of them, NIST P224, standardized by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is the elliptic curve y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus a 6 over z mod p. What is p there? It's the prime 2 to the 224 minus 2 to the 96 plus 1, which has a reasonably nice shape that allows fast arithmetic modulo p, fast reduction modulo p, and a 6 is the random looking number that I've written there. Well, I don't expect you to absorb any useful information from A6, some random number. The curve is y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus that random number A6. Similarly, NIST P256 is a larger standardized elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus something I didn't bother copying. Over the field z mod, here's a prime that's kind of nice to do reductions by. This prime is 2 to the 256 minus 2 to the 224 plus 2 to the 192 plus 2 to the 96 minus 1. Arithmetic modulo p is easier than arithmetic modulo a random prime number p. Another example of a curve designed for fast arithmetic and for being safe in cryptography, somewhat different shape, y squared equals x cubed plus 486662 x squared plus x, modulo the prime 2 to the 255 minus 19, also designed for fast arithmetic. Why are these numbers here? Why do we have minus 3? Why do we have a plus x of plus 486662? Well, there's security constraints and there's speed constraints, and I'm going to try to focus on these from a speed perspective. You've also been hearing quite a bit about various attacks on elliptic curves, and you're going to be hearing more about attacks on elliptic curves. How do you choose a curve? But for today, I'm going to assume that somebody gives you an elliptic curve, and then your task is to perform the fastest possible scalar multiplication on that curve. As you know, elliptic curve scalar multiplication means, well, each of these elliptic curves defines a group. If you're given some group element, let's assume it's an affine point x, y, your task is to multiply that by some given number n. Compute n times this point x, y. Compute np given n and given p. The cryptographic relevance is that in elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman and many other cryptographic protocols, this is the critical operation. This is what cryptography spends its time doing. The big question for this talk is, how fast is this operation? Again, assume the elliptic curve is fixed. Your task is to optimize the computation on that elliptic curve. Of course, you need to optimize the arithmetic modulo p, but beyond that, you can optimize the arithmetic on the elliptic curve itself, and that's the focus for this talk. There's lots of tweaks you can make in the problem and get similar questions with similar answers and slight differences. For example, you can look at multi-scalar exponentiation, multi-scalar multiplication, as you've heard about, mp plus nq, given m and p and n and q, p and q being points on the curve, and this is a critical operation for the elliptic curve Schnorr signature system and variations of it like ECDSA. There's lots of other variations that people care about. Let me briefly review what you know about addition chains. Got a couple of slides here on addition chains. All the formulas I've written down here are trivialities, like 8n plus 5 times p is 8np plus 5p. Well, scalar multiplication, of course, distributes, but this is not just a trivial formula. It's an algorithm that says if you want to compute 8n plus 5 times a point p, then compute 8n times a point p, which you do recursively using formulas like 2 times something times a point is compute the something times a point and double it, and then add 5p to the result. And, well, these last formulas, if you know p, 3p, 5p, 7p, which you can compute as shown above, then getting from 8np to 8n plus 1, 3, 5, or 7p just takes one addition. 8np, in turn, can be computed with just 3 doublings, starting from np, and then np is in one of these cases. as you've heard, these are these kinds of addition chains where you have some recursion for figuring out some multiple of p using previous multiples, preferably with as many doublings as possible. This gives you very fast arithmetic. To quantify that, the particular formulas I've written down, you've already heard about speeds for lots of addition chains. This particular addition chain, typical example, for every bit of your multiple, if you want to compute n times p, then for every bit of n, you have about log n, lg is, as usual, log base 2, log n doublings, and about a quarter as many additions. For every bit, there's one doubling, and on average, about a quarter of an addition. This is the, you've heard about sliding windows, this is length 3 sliding windows. Concrete example, typically in cryptography, people will have 256-bit numbers n, maybe smaller, maybe, say, 160-bit numbers n, but big numbers n where computing that n from np, computing discrete logs by the generic methods you've heard about is difficult. As a reminder, generic methods of computing n from np, if n has 256 bits, some random number in that range, then the generic methods will take 2 to the 128 operations. And that's a very large number of operations, so we feel safe using 256 bits. Even 160 bits is beyond computations that people want to do. If n has that range, then how long do these formulas take? How long do these typical addition chains take to compute n times p? Well, there's about 256 doublings and about 64 additions on average, at most something like 90 additions. All right, you can try to compress these addition chains, and you've heard several techniques. I'm not going to try to repeat everything you've heard. For example, using minus, you can try to, instead of multiplying np by 8, you can try multiplying it by 16, more doublings, and using negations. You've also heard about some curves having easy-to-compute endomorphisms. Koblitz curves are a characteristic 2 example where you can easily compute the Frobenius on a Koblitz curve, and that really speeds up the computation of scalar multiples. GLV curves are a high characteristic example where you can do the same thing. There's a few Koblitz curves, curves that are defined over F2. GLV curves, similarly, there's a few GLV curves, and these have some particularly easy to compute endomorphisms that you can throw into your addition chains. There's a lot of work on how to make all this as fast as possible. If you change the size of your sliding windows and combine with all the improvements people have, then the 0.25, or the number of additions there per bit, changes into something like 1 over log base 2 of n. And you can try to squeeze that a little bit more. But that's essentially the best we know how to do. The number of additions and doublings involved in computing np is about log n, log base 2 of n doublings, and about log n divided by 4 or divided by log n extra additions. All right. The problem then in computing np is to compute doublings and additions as quickly as possible. Let me focus on the case of doublings. Suppose that you have a curve with the following fairly simple form, y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus some number a6, which is not going to show up in the formulas. On this curve, you've already worked out the formulas for 2 times the point xy. It's some x double prime, y double prime, where x double prime and y double prime have these easy formulas in terms of lambda here, the slope of the tangent line at xy to this curve. You can see the 3x squared minus 3 from the derivative of x cubed minus 3x and 2y from the derivative of y squared, and there's lambda, the slope of the tangent line, which easily provides you with x double prime and y double prime, the coordinates of the double of the point, assuming you're not at the point at infinity. If y equals 0, then of course you have to do something special. In general, if you have infinity showing up as a point that you're adding or as the result of your addition, then you have some special formulas. But generically, most of the time, you have these formulas for the double of a point. How long do these formulas take? How much work does it take to evaluate the 2 times xy in the elliptic curve group law? Well, I've counted carefully, and I came up with 7 easy operations. Subtractions, multiplications by 2, which are just additions. Multiplications by 3 I've counted as one easy operation. So there's a minus, and another minus, and another minus, and another minus. 4 subtractions. There's a doubling, and a doubling, and a multiplication by 3. So that's a total of 7 easy operations. You might think the multiplication by 3, maybe that's as hard as doing 2 additions in the field. Well, so maybe I should count this as 8, but without worrying about that, these are easy operations in the field. And then there's some harder operations. There's an x squared that you have to compute. I know most of you have done some of these examples by hand, and of course the squarings take a lot more time than the additions and subtractions in the field. There's 2 squarings, x squared and lambda squared. Then there's another multiplication right there, the lambda times x minus x double prime. That's one multiplication beyond the squarings. And then the most terrifying operation here is the division by 2y. If you actually carry out that division, that's going to be most of your time in evaluating these formulas. Raises the question of, okay, how quickly can we divide in a finite field? How quickly can you compute a reciprocal modulo p? Well, easy answer is to use Fermat. Compute the reciprocal of g by computing the p minus second power of g. How long does it take to compute a p minus second power? Well, use the addition chains again for the exponent. Depending on exactly what p is, there will be about log p squarings modulo p, and about log p divided by 4 or log p divided by log p asymptotically, more multiplications. If p has a nice form, then the number of multiplications will tend to drop. For instance, if p is 2 to the 224 minus 2 to the 96 plus 1, then you can really try to optimize the addition chain for computing p minus second powers. And the best one that I know, I haven't tried to check if this is optimal, but it's a surprisingly small number of multiplications. There's 223 squarings and 11 more multiplications to compute a p minus second power. Exercise, figure out this addition chain. Well, it's not too hard looking at p to figure out some sequence of doublings and occasional additions that gives you p minus 2 starting from 1. In other words, some sequence of squarings and extra multiplications that computes a p minus second power. And of course, in a field of size q rather than just p, you can compute reciprocals the same way. You can compute 1 over g as g to the q minus 2. And back in the elliptic curve formulas, you can compute 1 over 2y as, well, compute 2y and then compute its q minus 2 power. Now, this is nowhere near the state of the art in division speeds. If you want to divide quickly, if you want to compute reciprocals in a finite field, then you could use Euclid's algorithm. And you could use all sorts of fancy improvements on Euclid's algorithm, the Lehmer-Knuth-Schoenhage algorithm, which is almost as fast as multiplication, not quite. And it's very complicated. It's something that as your numbers get bigger and bigger, it's surprisingly fast asymptotically, but there's some big constant factors, and it's something that you might not want to use in practice. Certainly, it is faster than Fermat. There's a lot of work that you can put into divisions. People talk about the IM ratio, just like the SM ratio. I is, of course, the time for inversion, M, the time for reciprocals in a field. M is the time for multiplication in your field. And then the IM ratio, well, up here I've said if you have p being 2 to the 224 minus something, you can compute p minus second powers. You can invert in 223 squarings, a few more multiplications. So that's maybe 150 times as expensive as a multiplication, considering that a squaring is a little less expensive than a general multiplication. The IM ratio there would be maybe 150. If you put a lot of work into Euclid's algorithm, you might be able to get that IM ratio down to 50 or 30 or 20 or even better. And if your field has some extra structure, if it's not just a random prime field, then you might be able to compute reciprocals even faster. For binary fields, there's tons of speedups in inversion, which I'm not going to get into. My focus for this talk is the large characteristic case. But even in fairly large characteristic, there's some special fields which give you fast reciprocals. I'm not going to describe these techniques for doing faster divisions because in the context of elliptic curve scalar multiplication, even if you put all the possible work into divisions, you realize that divisions are painful and you want to get rid of them using, for example, projective coordinates. The general philosophy of getting rid of divisions is delay your divisions. Say that, okay, divisions are expensive, even if you put tons of work into them, even if your IM ratio is as small as 10. You don't want to be doing a division. A division costs as much as, say, 10 multiplications. Or the way I've described it, it's 150 or so multiplications. Even with the fastest methods, divisions are expensive. you can save time by delaying divisions, by saying, okay, if somebody's told me to divide by 2y, if somebody's told me to divide by, I don't know, 12, then I won't actually divide by 12. I'll wait and remember that my number is something divided by 12, 7 divided by 12. And then how do I work with 7 divided by 12? Well, I just keep that fraction in the rest of my computation. I represent my field elements instead of in my original representation. I represent field elements as pairs of field elements in the original representation as fractions. Instead of writing A and dividing it by B, I just write the pair A comma B, where A and B are field elements representing A divided by B. And then at the end of the computation, when I need to tell somebody the quotient, then I go ahead and divide. But that one division compared to a whole elliptic curve scalar multiplication is not much of a bottleneck. So how long does it take to do the operations on fractions? Suddenly multiplications become very easy. Multiplying two fractions is just two multiplications in the field. Okay, it's not as easy as one, but it's not a big expense. Division takes two multiplications, and that's much easier than it was before to divide A over B by C over D. You just multiply A by D and multiply B by C. And what about adding? Well, addition becomes substantially more expensive than it was. If you want to add A over B to C over D, you have to multiply A by D, multiply B by C, multiply C by D, and do an extra field addition. The number of multiplications there is three multiplications, as opposed to a small fraction of a multiplication for doing addition normally. Despite the extra expense of addition and the slight extra expense of multiplication, the savings in division clearly makes this worthwhile. Remember what I had before, seven subtractions and easy operations, four subtractions and a few more easy operations, and then a few multiplications, a couple squarings, one more multiplication, and one division. If you total that up, it's something like 25, 30 multiplications in the field, which is a lot faster than using, say, 150 multiplications, well, 200 squarings, to do a single division. And you can optimize that a lot further. If you actually go ahead and work with these fractions, then what happens? Remember the formulas for elliptic curve doubling. The first thing you compute is the slope of the tangent line at xy. You compute 3x squared minus 3 divided by 2y. Well, suppose you're representing your quotients as fractions instead of actually dividing. Inside the computer, you compute 3x squared minus 3, you compute 2y, and then you just write down that pair of numbers, remembering that's equal to lambda. Next step of computing the double of xy is to compute lambda squared minus 2x, which is, well, lambda is something divided by 2y, so lambda squared is something divided by 2y squared. Compute that denominator, square 2y, and then subtracting 2x, you multiply 2x by that denominator, do a subtraction of the numerators. Similarly, computing y double prime, you end up with a denominator of the cube of 2y. So now you have these two numbers. Your double of xy is x double prime, y double prime, where each of those is represented as a fraction, where the denominators are the square of 2y and the cube of 2y. And now suppose you go further. Suppose you double that result again or add it to another point. Then you end up working with those denominators of x double prime and y double prime. And the way that I've described working with fractions, you forget that those came from the same y. You forget that these are the square and the cube of the same number, and you perform separate multiplications involving these numbers, which wastes time. If you remember that 2y squared and 2y cubed came from the same y, then you can save quite a bit of time. You can unify these denominators. Instead of representing x and y, or x double prime and y double prime as separate fractions, instead of writing x double prime as a pair of field elements, meaning the quotient, and instead of writing y double prime as a quotient, just remember one denominator, y. Well, okay, 2y, which is implicitly squared and cubed for x double prime and y double prime. And this is called Jacobian coordinates. You've heard about projective and I think a tiny bit about Jacobian coordinates. Instead of writing, you could have three numbers x, y, z, which represent the projective plane is a set of x, y, z's equivalence classes representing x over z and y over z in affine coordinates, or if you have the point infinity, you can also fit that in there. Jacobian coordinates, instead of x over z and y over z, you have x over z squared and y over z cubed. If you like, you can also motivate this x over z squared and y over z cubed in terms of the natural weights of functions on the elliptic curve, but it also pops up naturally from following through the field computations and saying what denominators appear inside the formulas. Suppose you take this x over z squared, y over z cubed. Suppose you have the result of, again, this is what you should be imagining happening naturally from following through the elliptic curve formulas. You naturally end up with x double prime having a denominator of the square of something, and y double prime has a denominator of the cube of the same thing. That gives a point of this form, something divided by 2y squared, something divided by 2y cubed. Now suppose you double that point. I'm going to relabel here. Suppose instead of 2 times x comma y, suppose somebody tells you these fractions, x over z squared, y over z cubed, by telling you x, y, z, and then you double that. Well, you get these same formulas for lambda, x double prime, and y double prime that I've substituted in. Instead of 3x squared, I have 3 times the square of x over z squared, minus 3, divided by 2 times, instead of divided by 2y, it's divided by 2y over z cubed, and clearing the denominators there, end up with, if I multiply by z to the fourth, this is something divided by 2yz, and then x double prime, if I double this x over z squared, y over z cubed, the x coordinate of the result is the square of this lambda, which has denominator of the square of 2yz and some complicated numerator, and then y double prime again ends up with the cube of that same number in its denominator and some complicated numerator. So if you take xy and you double that and try to unify your fractions, try to remember the one number that you have showing up to various powers in your denominators, then you have the sum 2y squared and cubed. And then if you double that, you end up with this 2yz squared and cubed, which has the same form. Once again, doubling a Jacobian point gives you another point that's naturally in Jacobian coordinates. To summarize this, here is doubling in Jacobian coordinates. If you have a point x over z squared, y over z cubed, and you double it on the curve, you end up with something over something squared, something over the same thing cubed, where, well, here's the formulas for those somethings, and here's actually a surprisingly small number of multiplications. All the divisions have gone away. That's what I started with, was, of course, we've eliminated divisions by just delaying them by remembering we're going to divide by z squared and z cubed later on. And then the computation of this x2, y2, z2 involves how much work? Well, it's very little work here. This is even less work than you would get from projective coordinates. It's a surprisingly small amount. We've got, let's see, x squared and then z to the fourth. You compute a z squared and then square it again. And then there's a y squared, and y squared you can reuse here, and multiplication by x. And, well, okay, I think I've written down the complete list of multiplications involved here. There's 9 multiplications, of which 6 are squarings. And then there's some more work. There's still the same 4 subtractions that we had before, and then there's some multiplications by 4, and somehow an 8 has shown up here, and, well, there's the 3s, and, okay, lots of numbers have shown up. But still, multiplying by 8 is just a few doublings. It's much faster, a few field doublings. It's much faster than a field multiplication. So we don't worry too much about the subtractions and multiplications by 4, by 8, by 3, etc. Basically, the operations here are 3 multiplications plus 6 more squarings. You should remember, as you're doing those field operations, don't forget everything you know about doing field arithmetic quickly. You should not simply say, I have field arithmetic consisting of squarings and multiplications. You should have field arithmetic consisting of evaluating any quadratic form, and in general you should try to delay carries, as I was saying on Monday. When you look at this y2, for instance, multiplying alpha by something and then subtracting the square of y squared, instead of computing the alpha times something and that square and then subtracting them with lots of reductions in the middle, you should delay all the reductions mod p, all the carries, until you've done the subtraction. Evaluate this whole quadratic form of alpha times something computed minus 8 times the square of something computed. Evaluate those two multiplications, a multiplication and a squaring, subtract the results, and then reduce modulo p and do all your carries that you need to write to turn polynomials into fairly small integers. So instead of having 9 reductions here, you have only 8 reductions. That kind of thing saves 5% of your runtime. There's lots of further improvements that people have, and let me give you the flavor of how people squeeze even more operations out of these formulas. Remember, what we started with was doing fewer multiplications and squarings, but one division. And that division is much more work than what we have now, this 6 squarings and 3 multiplications. Even the fastest division methods cannot compete with this. But we can do even better this way. Suppose that, remember this alpha here. What is alpha? It's 3x squared minus 3z to the 4th. Well, you work through the formulas, you can check that's what's happening. This can be computed more easily because it's basically a difference of squares. Aside from the 3, it's x squared minus the square of z squared. Instead of computing x squared and computing z squared separately, you can compute z squared first and then subtract from x, add to x, multiply those together instead of having what did I have here before? Square x, square z squared again, that's 3 squarings, versus square z, and then do one multiplication. We've gotten rid of 3 squarings and replaced them by one squaring and one multiplication, which is certainly faster. 2 squarings is more expensive than one multiplication. One squaring is less expensive, but 2 is more expensive. How much work do we have now? Well, instead of 6 squarings and 3 multiplications, we have 4 squarings and 4 multiplications, which actually in a lot of the literature you'll find this quoted as the cost of Jacobian coordinate point doubling on a short form Weierstrass curve with a minus 3 in the curve equation. I should emphasize here that only if you have x cubed minus 3x plus something do you end up with this speed up of factoring the 3x squared minus 3z to the 4th. Because the 3x squared minus 3z to the 4th, that was from the slope of the tangent line with x replaced by x over z squared. Originally, the curve equation, y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus a6, produced a part of the slope of the tangent line of 3x squared minus 3. That's the derivative of x cubed minus 3x. And that factors nicely. That's x minus 1 times x plus 1. When you make it Jacobian, projected with weighted coordinates, when you change x to x over z squared, it still factors nicely. That wouldn't be true if we started with, say, x cubed minus 5x plus something. Then we would have the derivative 3x squared minus 5, and that does not factor nicely. Unless if 5 were, say, 12, then it does factor nicely again. But except for 3 times squares, you don't get a nice factorization of this derivative, and you don't save the multiplication here. Well, you don't save the 2 squarings for one multiplication. People choose curve equations so that they get this kind of speed up. Looking ahead to the formulas dictates the choices. The only reason that people have x cubed minus 3x inside these popular standard elliptic curves is to allow this speed up in the formulas, which requires, when you're choosing the curves, looking ahead to, okay, how are we going to do this computation? And hey, look, there's a speed up if we've chosen a minus 3. Yeah? Unless you set up the query, can you about half a multiplication? At best, half a multiplication. That's right. If a squaring were exactly half a multiplication, then this would not be saving anything. But that's the best, that's, okay, with naive multiplication methods, asymptotically a squaring reduces to one-half plus epsilon multiplications. On the other hand, with the fastest methods we have, a squaring is asymptotically two-thirds plus epsilon of a multiplication. And in practice, for realistic cryptographic sizes, a squaring might be frequently quoted is an SM ratio of 0.8. A squaring is about as expensive as 0.8 multiplications. Or in some more optimized code recently, I've been finding a squaring multiplication ratio of about two-thirds. One-half is the best you can imagine, and in that case, yes, replacing 2 squarings by a multiplication would be no savings at all. If a squaring is more expensive than that, then it's a good idea. Okay, there's more speedups. For instance, if you look at a general pattern of way you can speed up some formulas, if you look at the circuit for a computation and you see that you're taking two inputs, f and g, and you're multiplying them every which way. You're multiplying f by f and g by g and multiplying f by g with, let's say for simplicity, an extra factor of 2, then you can do that instead of with 2 squarings and one multiplication, you can do it with 3 squarings. which is faster than two squarings and a multiplication, because one squaring is faster than one multiplication, simply because f plus g squared is f squared plus g squared plus 2fg. And if you're computing f squared and g squared on the side, then this is a faster way to compute f times g, or 2 times f times g. You might be worried about the 2 if it does not show up inside your doubling formulas for an elliptic curve or whatever computation you're doing. What if you only want fg and not 2fg? Well, you can take fg and divide it by 2, which requires, if you have an odd number, adding p and then dividing it by 2. On the other hand, you could also say, wait a minute, I never have to do divisions. I can just multiply my numerator and denominator by 2, and then you never have to do a division by 2. Inside the doubling formulas, you might have forgotten about the formulas by now, but let me see if I can show you both. Here we go. Inside these formulas, you look around them, and you notice that somewhere here, there is a 2yz. There it is. Z2 is 2yz. And I remember squaring y squared right there, and I remember squaring z. Even with the speed up in computing alpha, we were still squaring z, and we're squaring y, and we're multiplying y by z with the convenient factor of 2. So there's no reason to do that as a multiplication of y by z. You can just square y plus z and then subtract off y squared and z squared, which are computed separately. And this replaces a multiplication with a squaring, so the final total, and this is the best that anybody has so far. Maybe there's more speedups, but for Jacobian point doubling on a short Weierstrass curve with a 4 being minus 3, the fastest we have is 3 multiplications, 3 field multiplications, and 5 field squarings, and some subtractions and doublings and so on in the field. Basically, 3 multiplications and 5 squarings to do a doubling in these coordinates on an elliptic curve. And this is much, much faster than what we started with involving a division. No matter how fast your divisions are, they're not going to be this fast. Of course, doubling is only part of the picture. You also have to be able to add different points. And now I'm not going to take you through all the formulas. There's an amazing number of formulas in the literature, an amazing number of curve shapes. And people tend to focus on the ones that are the most promising, seem to provide the best speeds. But even in those cases, there's still, say, doubling formulas and addition formulas, and you can look at some other operations. I'm not going to show you the addition formulas. I'm just going to say that you can do addition of distinct points in Jacobian coordinates on these same forms of curves, on short Weierstrass form curves, using 16 multiplications, of which 5 are squarings. So an addition is substantially more expensive than doubling. A doubling is just 8 instead of 16, 8 multiplications, and out of those 8, a relatively large fraction of those are squarings. So the addition is more than twice as expensive as a doubling. On the other hand, we're doing only a small fraction as many additions compared to doublings. Remember the fractions from before. With typical addition chains, you might have a quarter as many additions as doublings. For every bit of your multiple, if you're computing NP, then where P is a point on your elliptic curve, then for every bit of N, you do one doubling, and for a quarter of the bits, say, you're doing an addition. And then maybe with fancier addition chains, addition subtraction chains, you do, say, a fifth as many or a sixth as many additions as you do doublings. And, well, if your doubling is under half the cost of the addition, then dividing the additions by 4 or 5 or 6 for how frequently they happen means that additions are still noticeable compared to doublings. They definitely add to the cost, but they're not as dominant as you might first expect looking at the 5 squarings and 11 more multiplications. You can speed up these formulas in the same ways I've been mentioning before. This is the result of trying to get as many squarings as possible and trying to squeeze out as much work as possible. But you can also delay reductions. Don't forget about what you know about fast field arithmetic in evaluating these formulas. Often people will write papers where they just count, say, the total number of multiplications. That's the most crude way to evaluate how expensive a formula is. And then more subtle is start evaluating number of squarings plus number of multiplications. And then more subtle is evaluate number of multiplications, number of squarings, number of reductions. And then you can evaluate multiplications, squarings, reductions, additions, subtractions, etc. And even adding reductions into the picture makes the analysis complicated enough that people tend not to do that. People tend to just count multiplications and maybe squarings. If, on the other hand, you want the fastest arithmetic, you really should pay attention to the reductions and the other operations. There's more speedups. Suppose you're not just doing one doubling, one addition, but you're doing a whole sequence of doublings and additions in the context of a scalar multiplication or in some other context. You frequently find yourself adding one number to other numbers where the one number is reused, one point to other points. Here I've written down a Jacobian coordinate point, x over z squared, y over z cubed, which might be, say, remember the addition chain before, you might have, say, 3p, 5p, 7p. Those are points that are added every time you see an 8n plus 5 times p. Every time you have something times p that you want to compute recursively, where the something is of the form 8n plus 5, you reuse 5p. And every time it's 8n plus 7, you reuse 7p. It's very frequent for a point to be reused. And, well, to the extent that a point is reused, here's a speed up in it. If you add one point to another and write down the complicated formulas for it, then you immediately see some of the computations you do depend only on the first point, and some computations depend only on the second. You end up computing these denominators. For doubling, we never had to compute the cube. That's one of the savings in doublings. But for addition of two points, you end up having to compute these denominators anyway, and those z1 squared, z1 cubed depend only on the first point that you're adding, and you also compute something depending on the second point alone. If you reuse the first point, then you can also reuse these intermediate values that depend only on the first point. These computations are effectively less expensive. The z1 squared is something that you should not think of as being as costly as a normal squaring, because it's something you can reuse if you are reusing that point, adding it to more than one other point. This has a name in the literature. Storing z1 squared and z1 cubed for future use is called Chudnovsky coordinates. Actually, there's this Chudnovsky paper that has a huge number of different interesting formulas, and this is just one of the things they were saying in there. But I think of this as a mindless optimization that you should do when you look at some formulas and notice that you've got the same result reused, a result that depends on just one of your points. Of course you can reuse it, you can cache it, you should be doing that automatically. And if you tell your compiler, here is straight line code, no loops, if you tell your compiler, here's straight line code for computing 13 times a point, then it will automatically detect this. You don't have to think about it at all. If you're looking at formulas and thinking how fast will those formulas be, then you should be happy with computations like z1 squared, which depend only on the point, the first point that you're adding, or only on one of the points. So if you reuse that point, then you can reuse that square. And this saves a couple of multiplications. Another speed up, depending on how fast your division is. I put a question mark here. This is not necessarily a good idea, but frequently it's a good idea to not be as extreme as I was before about delaying all the divisions. You don't have to represent your numbers as fractions. You don't have to wait on doing a division. And sometimes it's a good idea to do another division. I said so far there's just one division at the end of your computation. You have some fraction and somebody wants a single field element, so then you have to do a division. And hopefully that's not a big part of the computation. But if your divisions are reasonably fast, then maybe you should do more of them. The only reason to avoid divisions was because they're expensive, but they're not so expensive that we can't afford one or two or maybe three or four. So if you have your division being fast enough, then maybe you should delay fewer of the divisions. You should have, say, two or three divisions in your computation. Typical example where people will do some more divisions is looking at p, 3p, 5p, 7p, or whatever shows up as being reused inside your addition chains. Instead of writing those in Jacobian coordinates, you could write them in affine coordinates. You could divide out the z's for all those. And that has the advantage that later on, you don't have to think about the z's. The z's have all been replaced by 1, and that, of course, saves time whenever you multiply those z's by other x's and y's from other points. If you convert p, 3p, 5p, and 7p, then if you convert them to affine coordinates, if you divide out their z's, then you save multiplications, field multiplications, every time you add those to another point. There is a cost of doing that. There's a cost of converting from Jacobian coordinates to affine coordinates, you have to do a division by z, and actually from what I've written down here, there's 4 points I'm converting. Now, wait a minute, p is already an affine form. Probably somebody gave you p as an x, y. You don't have to do any conversion there. It's x, y, 1, already naturally in affine coordinates. But there's 3 more points here, and what I wrote on the slide is that you only need 1 division to convert all those points out of Jacobian coordinates. The trick for doing that, if you have, say, 3 z's that you want to divide by, suppose you have z3 and z5, and you want to divide by both z3 and z5, or by z3 squared, z5 squared, you want the reciprocal of z3 and the reciprocal of z5. And then you can square those, cube those, multiply them by x's and y's. That takes only 1 reciprocal, 1 division, because the reciprocal of z3 and the reciprocal of z5 are z5 and z3 times the reciprocal of z3, z5. If you want to invert 2 numbers, you multiply them together, invert the product, and then multiply by the original numbers. And same for 3 or more numbers. This is often called Montgomery's trick for inversion of several numbers. This replaces 1 division by, well, if you have many divisions, each one turns into 3 multiplications, and then you have 1 final division to do. And, okay, so with 1 division, which is not too expensive, and a bunch of multiplications, you can convert all these 3p, 5p, 7p to affine coordinates, which means all their z's are 1. They don't have any multiplications by their z's that I was talking about before, and every addition of those points saves time. How much time is saved versus the cost of this extra, cost of this extra addition? Well, it's unclear. It depends how fast your divisions are. For some fields, some division methods, it's good. For others, it's not. This is what people call mixed coordinates, when you have addition of an affine point to a Jacobian point, which requires converting some of these intermediate results to affine. And maybe it's a good idea. Here's something completely different, Montgomery-shape elliptic curves. Instead of x cubed minus 3x plus a constant, let's take x cubed plus a small number x squared plus x. Y squared equals that with a constant term, and a6 equal to 0, a4 equal to 1, and a2 here is preferably small, or to be precise, a2 should be congruent to 2 mod 4, and a small integer subject to that, preferably. This is called a Montgomery form elliptic curve, and on this elliptic curve, there are some amazingly concise formulas for multiplying a point by n. Here I've written down x1, comma, I've suppressed y's, I'm just working with the x's here. If you want, you can also put in the y's, and there's an exercise, this is not just off the cuff, this is an exercise that's on the sheet for later, to figure out what the y is in the nth multiple of x1, comma, y1. But the formulas for the x's are just amazingly short. This is complete recursive formulas for figuring out xn, comma, zn, such that their quotient, the 1 division at the end, is n times some original point x1. And the formulas look like, say, x2 is x1 squared minus z1 squared, where z1 is 1, square that, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can see a very small number of multiplications and additions and subtractions here and some squarings. This gives you x n z n such that, again, that's the x-coordinate of the nth multiple of your point. I said at the bottom here, again, you can figure out y, and that's what the exercise is on this afternoon, or a lot of cryptographic protocols just work with the x's, in part motivated by, well, let's not bother computing y, and in part because, well, there's just no point in worrying about the y. Some protocols do need the y, but a lot of protocols, you can just use these formulas and not even think about the y-coordinates. These formulas actually, well, they rely very much on the shape of the curve here. The fact that a4 is 1 and a6 is 0 gives a lot of the simplifications that are implicit in these formulas. If you like, you can try working out what happens if a4 is something different from 1 or if a6 is something else. These formulas are, again, amazingly short. They were published at the same time in 2 papers independently, one being Montgomery's famous 1987 paper on optimization of the elliptic curve method for integer factorization, and another paper being the famous Chudnovsky paper that I mentioned before with all sorts of interesting formulas. Montgomery gets all the credit for these formulas because he went one step further. He optimized these formulas, noticing how many additions and, well, let's forget additions, how many multiplications and squarings do you see here? Looks like a squaring, 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 and then reuse the squaring, there's a multiplication, and reuse it, and then another multiplication, and here's four more multiplications, squaring, squaring, another multiplication. You count, it sounds like 14 multiplications, many of which are squarings, but 14 multiplications for doing an addition and a doubling. Here we're getting 2m times a point and 2m plus 1 times a point. Montgomery improved the 14 to 10, which is quite a huge speed up, and that's why he gets all the credit for these formulas. Here's his revised formulas. These are so fast that you can fit the complete data flow diagram onto one page here, which I certainly could not do for the addition and doubling formulas as shown you before. Even if I were just working with x-coordinates, it would be more complicated than this. This takes xm, zm, and then adds them and subtracts them. This is part of the trickiness that Montgomery saw, which is not immediately obvious from the original formulas, and then does some multiplications and more multiplications and some additions, etc. And there's some nice pattern here of additions, subtractions, interleaved with multiplications. There's a multiplication by a2 minus 2 over 4, which I told you should be small integer. Hopefully that multiplication can be a multiplication by a sufficiently small number that it's very fast to do that one, easier than a general field multiplication. There's a multiplication by x1 showing up there. And, okay, that's the complete formulas for getting 2m times a point and 2m plus 1 times a point from m and m plus 1 times a point. Or if you flip around the roles of m and m plus 1, then you get 2m plus 1 and 2m plus 2 times a point. These recursive formulas allow you to get to any number, comma, that number plus 1, times your original point, p, which is x1, comma, something. All right, looking at this, you see, well, you can check that this gives the same results as before. You can check that those results are consistent with the usual elliptic curve formulas. Fair amount of calculation to do that check, but you can do it. These are correct elliptic curve formulas with just 10 multiplications for each bit of your number to do both an addition and a multiplication. If your a2 minus 2 over 4 is a small integer, then let's just forget about that multiplication by a small number. Now there's just 9 multiplications for each bit of your exponent, your scalar multiple, n. Now, what did Jacobian coordinates have us doing? Remember, there were 3 multiplications, 5 squarings for each doubling in Jacobian coordinates, and occasional additions. Occasionally, 16 more multiplications, of which some were squarings. Now, the occasions are sufficiently frequent that even though the doublings by themselves might sound better, do sound better in Montgomery, 5 squarings and 3 multiplications is definitely better than 4 squarings and 5 more multiplications. Having to add in the, say, quarter of the time or a sixth of the time, having to add in 16 more multiplications makes Jacobian coordinates slower. Asymptotically, as n gets bigger and bigger, these additions disappear, and you just have doubling. And then Jacobian coordinates asymptotically are just 8 multiplications, many of which are squarings, for each bit of n. And that's better than Montgomery, which is 9. But for any realistic size of n, Montgomery form gives quite a speed up. And right now, those are the speed records that we have. Let me pull together the speeds of field multiplication and the elliptic curve operations and show you concretely how fast our current elliptic curve scalar multiplication software is. For a particular elliptic curve, this was the curve 25519 that I mentioned before, the curve y squared equals x cubed plus something, 486662 x squared plus x. This is Montgomery form, and this 486662 is something congruent to 2 modulo 4, and as small as possible, which might make you think, wait a minute, shouldn't it be 2? No, that's not an elliptic curve. What about, shouldn't it be 6? Isn't that the smallest number you could put there that's congruent to 2 modulo 4? Well, that is, but it doesn't satisfy other security constraints on the curve, like you want the number of points on the curve to be a prime or something prime times a small number, and you also want the number of points on the twist of the curve to be a prime times a small number. And there's more security constraints and convenience constraints, which actually exclude the first 100,000 or so choices of this number, but 486662 is still pretty small. Multiplying by that minus 2 over 4 is a lot easier than a general multiplication. All right, so this is some elliptic curve, modulo 2 to the 255 minus 19, suitable for cryptographic use, satisfies all the security constraints we have. How fast is it on, for example, a Pentium M on my laptop? This is not the latest Intel chip, but it's a fairly typical one. Every Pentium M cycle does at most one floating point operation, at most one floating point multiplication, or you could do a floating point subtraction, floating point addition. Now, the number of cycles for a cryptographic program is at least the number of floating point multiplications plus number of floating point additions, number of floating point subtractions. It could be quite a lot more than that, but I've written down some numbers here saying that actually it's very close to that. For this software, the number of cycles, if you have, say, a 1.3 gigahertz Pentium M, that means there's 1,300 cycles per microsecond. So 640,000 cycles is something like half of a millisecond. Can do 2,000 of these scalar multiplications every second, depending on your CPU speed. Out of those 640,000 cycles, most of them, 92% of them, are filled with floating point operations. And then there's some overhead, 8% of other operations. Most of the other operations are overlapped with floating point. There's a little bit of overhead here. But because these numbers are close, you can pretty much understand how fast the software is, where the time is going inside this elliptic curve scalar multiplication by just looking at how many floating point operations there are. As I mentioned on Monday, floating point is the fastest way to do arithmetic on a lot of chips, and the Pentium M is one of those chips. I said before that divisions versus the rest of scalar multiplication is, well, you're not too worried about the time for division if you're just doing one. And here's a concrete form of that. Even with Fermat's method of computing reciprocals, computing p minus 2 power, which for this prime p, 2 to the 255 minus 19, you can do with 254 squarings, 11 multiplications. Those occupy 44,000 floating point operations versus all of the other elliptic curve scalar multiplication operations occupy 500,000, more than 500,000 floating point operations. So you can see that the division at the end is a small fraction of that. And maybe it's worth optimizing, but it's under 10% of the total time here, time being measured by floating point operations, which, as I said, is close to the truth. If you optimize this, maybe you could get it to 20,000 or fewer, but, well, there's not much point since it's not a very big part of the computation. The big part of the computation is for every bit of n, for every bit of your 255-bit multiple that you might use, you do some number, well, 2,000 floating point operations, 2140 floating point operations, to do Montgomery's double and add formulas. And that accounts for the 500 or so thousand operations that this is taking. And then there's the division and a little bit of extra setup time. How about the squarings versus multiplications and the multiplication by a small constant, additions and subtractions involved in Montgomery's formulas? Well, here's to give you a concrete picture of the SM ratio and where the time is going inside these 2140 operations, each of which is one cycle. Well, the addition, each addition takes 10 cycles, and each squaring takes 162, and each multiplication takes 243. Well, to be precise, it's taking that many floating point operations, and there's a little extra cost for the for cycles that occasionally have to do something other than floating point multiplications and additions and so on. Multiplying by a small constant is actually substantially more expensive than an addition or subtraction. 55 floating point operations to multiply by this small number instead of 10 for an addition or subtraction. It's a lot less expensive than a squaring or a general multiplication, 162 or 243, but it's still quite noticeable and counts a lot more than an addition or subtraction. If you're trying to evaluate how expensive a formula is, then you should keep numbers like this in mind. An addition is a lot faster than a general multiplication. A multiplication by a small number is substantially faster, say 5 times faster. A squaring, the SM ratio here, 162 over 243, that's 2/3 exactly, is the SM ratio for this field arithmetic implementation, for this field that's been designed for the fastest arithmetic that we can do. And there's a little bit of extra work inside the code for selecting which bits you're using inside the recursion, whether you're going from M and M plus 1 to M to 2M and 2M plus 1, or 2M plus 1 and 2M plus 2. But basically, the bulk of the work, more than half the work, is in the 5 multiplications. A lot of the rest of it is in the 4 squarings, which are only half the work about of the multiplications, because each squaring is only about 2/3 of a multiplication, and then some extra effort for everything else. Digging down one more layer, and then I'll stop on the partitioning of the time here. Where do these numbers like 10 and 162 and 243 come from? Well, the 10 floating point operations to add two integers comes from simply representing each integer as 10 coefficients of a polynomial. Each integer is represented in some non-integer radix as a sum of 10 floating point numbers. And if each of those floating point numbers can handle an integer up to 2 to the 25 or so, then 10 of them is enough to handle an integer up to 2 to the 255. Adding two of those polynomials, each with 10 coefficients, takes 10 floating point additions. And no extra work, because you delay all the reductions and carries after doing an addition or subtraction. Multiplication, well, multiplication of two polynomials, each of which has 10 coefficients, takes 10 squared multiplications of the coefficients, and then 9 squared additions, and then there's a lot of extra work, actually, for doing reductions modulo p. Despite p being chosen to make this as fast as possible, it's still a noticeable cost, and then there's carries, which you have to do for any integer multiplication, which occupy 44 floating point operations out of the 243. That's quite significant as well. If you add this all up, then in terms of the 10, the number of coefficients, it's 2 times 10 squared plus 4 times 10 plus 3. That's the 243, as there it is as a quadratic function of the number of coefficients of the polynomials representing integers. And for squarings, there's a lot of savings. You save, well, 2 goes down to 1 for the coefficient of 10 squared. There's only half as many floating point multiplications and additions. Plus, there's all this overhead, 4 goes up to 6, and that's what makes squaring not quite twice as fast as a multiplication. It's two-thirds as fast, two-thirds the time of a multiplication. All right, so those are some concrete numbers which show how fast this software is. And if you want to speed things up, then even saving an addition would save a little bit, and the time here would save 1%, say, to save a couple of additions, or trying to make this number a lot smaller would maybe reduce the time by 55 operations. This should give you some concrete idea of how expensive field operations are. If you change your field, then these numbers all change, and you have to redo the analysis or try to model what happens with these numbers as your field changes. All right, one more slide. Just to advertise the course that I'm giving, if you like any of this stuff or some other stuff that I'm going to be doing in the course, let me describe to you what the stuff is so you can decide for yourself whether it sounds like fun. It's going to be a total of 36 hours per day. No, a total of 36 hours spread over 3 weeks, 23rd of October to 17th of November. In the middle of that is the computational number theory and applications to cryptography workshop. So we're going to have, out of those 4 weeks, 3 of them will be this course, and one of them will be the workshop, big conference, lots of people coming and talking about their research. Let's see. The basic questions in this course are not just, I've been talking about secret sharing, how to do elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman, which is how you share secrets between two people through a public channel. But there's some other critical cryptographic operations that people need to do. To encrypt data and authenticate data, you need to take your short secret and turn it into a lot of secrets. You have to expand your short secret key into a large secret key. You then have to use that to somehow authenticate data or sign data. The difference here is a signature is something that everybody can check. An authenticator is something that can be checked by the people who can compute it. So if you have private communication between two people who share a secret, they can authenticate their data, which is faster than signing it. Signing is something you do for public communication. You sign something and everybody can check your signature, even people beyond you, people who are not able to sign data themselves. Those are the four basic operations in cryptography. I've been summarizing what happens for sharing secrets, but there's lots of these other functions that I am going to cover in the course. I want to explain carefully how fast computers are, how fast typical CPUs are, how fast these functions are in software for those CPUs. So we'll go through the architecture of a CPU and what the CPUs like to do and how you should think about CPU speed, and then how to optimize these functions for CPUs. How secure are these functions? What attacks do we know? And, well, how fast are those attacks? How safe are these functions? And then what are the alternatives? And this is maybe the most interesting part of cryptography. What differentiates cryptography from, well, cryptographic algorithm design from general algorithm design is that you have a whole big space of functions you can choose. In my talks, I've been saying, okay, somebody gives you a field. How do you do arithmetic? Somebody gives you a curve. How do you do arithmetic on that standard curve? But somebody had to come up with the standard, and maybe there's better standards. How do you choose a cryptographic function in light of the speed and the security? What functions are safe, and out of those functions, which ones are fastest? So why are these functions the particular ones that I'm looking at? That's also going to occupy quite a bit of my time. I have a web page with a little bit of information about what I'm covering and what people should know in advance in the course. So if you have some interest in that, then go look at that web page and decide whether you're interested in sitting in on the course. Thanks for your attention. Yeah, the software is all publicly available. If you want to go to cr.yp.to/ecdh, that's elliptic curve diffie-hellman.html, then you get the software which does exactly this. It's in the public domain. It also works on other chips other than the Pentium M. And you can time it for yourself, and it runs at this speed. Use it in whatever your cryptographic software is. What language did I use? Well, for a long time I was using C and trying to convince the C compiler to produce the assembly language that I wanted because, well, in the end, if you want to optimize software for chips, you need to at least think about what the chip does. And in my head, for many years, I was doing that in assembly language, but trying to write the code in C, because the C compiler is a lot more compact in its input language than the assembly language is. The difficulty is that the compiler is a complicated function of your C to your assembly language. So I had to get that function in my head and then invert it to write the C code, which would convince the compiler to produce the desired assembly language. That was a little bit painful. And then I also tried writing stuff in assembly language directly, which was also a little bit painful because you have to deal with registers manually and do a lot of work. So I ended up designing my own programming language called Qasm, which made it tolerable to actually write the software for optimized for several chips. I've been using that for various cryptographic tools. And hey, if you want to hear more about how you can actually do fast code for a bunch of CPUs without suffering painfully through negotiating with your compiler and without suffering through conventional assembly languages, then I'll be talking about Qasm in this course. So there's a new language behind the scenes which is supporting all of the programming effort here, and minimizing programming time has been a major part of making this actually work at the speeds that I'm talking about here. If you write simple C code for exactly these floating point operations, you find it taking something like 3 times as many cycles. So you really have to put work into making the compiler or whatever language you have, making that do what you want so that the number of cycles is close to the lower bound that you might imagine for that computation.